Insurance agents from around the world, welcome to the Insurance Guys Podcast. My name is Scott Howell, your fearless host and leader, insurance agency owner and insurance evangelist for I Protect Insurance and Financial Services, based out of Huntsville, Alabama. And before we get started on today's episode, please help me welcome. He is a 6'3" sophomore from Mobile, Alabama, Parade First Team All-American, Rivals five-star recruit. He is a fantastic insurance agent and a great American. Ladies and gentlemen, please stand and welcome my friend, Mr. Bradley Flowers. How are you, Bradley?
I'm great. How are you?
Best I've ever been, Bradley. We got a lot to talk about today.
Yeah.
First of all, I think it's important to note that we are doing today's and this week's batch file of podcast remotely. Bradley and his wife, Laurel, are expecting a baby here in the next few weeks that could happen at any moment.
Probably about the time you guys are listening to this, it'll have happened.
I hope it is. I hope it's about that time instead of halfway through this podcast. But yeah, we kind of made the command decision. I think it was a smart decision because of the timing of her possibly going into labor at any moment. I called Bradley, I believe it was Friday, and I said, hey, man, listen, I can still come down there. No problem. I can make it happen. And he's like, man, I would hate for you to get down here, you know, check into a hotel and me call and say, hey, we're at the hospital. We're not going to be able to podcast. So I think that was the right decision.
I have to podcast from the delivery room. That would be right. That wouldn't go over well.
So for all of you that haven't heard, probably a lot of people haven't, I wanted to real briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but about 2-3 weeks ago now, Bradley and I had already batch filed podcast to kind of get us through until today. And I was here in my office working and had not been feeling real good for the past 2-3 days. Just, you know how you feel when you think, well, maybe I'm getting sick kind of thing, but there's nothing. It almost sneaks up on you, you know?
Yep.
I got up that morning and I was like, man, I feel like I've got a bowling ball in my stomach. I come to the office. Clint comes over. It's Wednesday. We go up, we go eat. And while we're eating, I said, you ever feel like you got a bowling ball in your stomach? He was like, no, not really. No. Come back to the office. He leaves. He leaves about 2. I start running a fever, nausea. So I just stand up from my computer and turn it off, stand up, get my stuff, and I go home. I never do that. Never. Get to the house, walk in the door, tell my wife I got to go to bed. I don't feel good. Don't know what it is. That night, a bowling ball turned from a bowling ball to hot lava in my stomach. So I get up at 6 the next morning, get dressed, go to my doctor. They start running tests, COVID, flu. I'm like, I'm telling y'all, whatever's going on with me is not that. So they finally send me for a CT scan, and 30 minutes later, I am in surgery with a ruptured appendix that has already ruptured, which is the bad news, because if you catch that before it ruptures, that's like a drive-by surgery. Like, you go in, they operate.
They give you Chick-fil-A while they're operating on you.
100%. Next day, you're good. Well, because mine had already ruptured and was leaking fecal matter into my abdomen, I was in the hospital for 6 days. About 2 or 3 of those were pretty touch and go.
Yeah.
Finally came out, spent another week at home recovering. And this was the first time in my life I had ever gotten something like this sick. And usually I bounce back 2-3 days, I'm good after whatever. This time it was like this slow incremental 5% getting better a day. And I don't think I'm still back to 100%. I think I'm probably at about 90, but man, I can still get winded going from the bathroom to our living room, you know, but I'm certainly glad to be above water right now, above ground.
Well, I'm glad you're better. And what the listeners probably don't know is when you had your hip surgery last year, you were at home preparing to do the hip surgery, and Aaron Robertson and I think along with David Carruthers, sent you a singing telegram,
right,
wishing you well. And for those of you trying to imagine it, it's exactly what you thought it was. Kim texted me and said one of the last things Scott said before he went under for the surgery is, please no singing telegrams.
I did. That was one of the very last things I said. Man, what a crazy 3 weeks that was. I have played a lot
I'm
of
glad you were up. Not down here when that happened.
Oh, my gosh. That's exactly what I told Kim. I said, imagine if we'd been on vacation in Mexico or somewhere. or Costa Rica or Dominican Republic, and now you're like in a hospital somewhere where there's no air conditioning.
So with my health insurance with Blue Cross, I have a benefit, and it's if you are in a foreign country and you're so sick that you have to go into the hospital, Blue Cross will send a private plane to come get me.
Wow.
And it's $100 copay.
Wow.
Best bet, I keep that bad boy in my wallet.
So I'm going to have to parlay off that, Bradley, and get with my Blue Cross Blue Shield rep and see if that option's available for us, because as much as Kim and I like to travel overseas, that would be...
Mm-hmm. You travel more overseas than I do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to the DR, the Dominican Republic, June the 5th, I believe, for a week. I love to travel overseas. I think traveling overseas from the perspective of gaining a different lens in terms of your perceptions, this confirmation bias that everybody has now, depending on if you're blue or red. And I just think traveling overseas expands your horizons so much in terms of having that lens that you now look through to say, well, no, I've actually been there. Let me tell you what it's like. You know, I've always been jealous of you going down to Cuba, and I don't know that it seems like I've read somewhere that's not quite as easy as it was a few years ago when you did it.
I wouldn't go now.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard. Hey, guys, we've got an outstanding podcast for you guys today. And, you know, our mission on this podcast has never changed. Not since, I guess, back in July of 2017. It has never changed. It is to help insurance agents any way we can, to try to provide value to you guys so that when you turn this on, listen to it, and turn it off, you say, "What? You know what? I learned something today I didn't know before I started." Or something that you could implement in your agency or try, and hopefully that little hinge will take you to that next level that you want to get to. So without further ado, I want to introduce our rock star guest today, who is a dear friend of mine as well. She is originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and she currently resides in Columbus, Ohio. She is married to the ruggedly handsome Ian, and they have three fur babies, Claude, Remy, and Ronald. She is a graduate of Ohio State University. And Bradley, we never talked about this ever. I've never even really scratched the surface, but she is also a retired competitive trap shooter. For those of you that know her, she has been director of sales for Safe Chain, director of sales at Safe Harbor, and the VP of revenue for Agency Zoom. Ladies and gentlemen, she is now currently the president of Indium, an industry-leading agency network focused on best-in-class market access, technology, and community for growth-centric independent insurance agents. She is the president of Indium. And ladies and gentlemen, it is my profound honor today to introduce to you my friend, Miss Kat Turnus. How are you, Kat?
I'm good. How are you this morning?
Man, I'm the best. I'm the best. I'm trying to keep this one a little more reserved because we've got four podcasts today, and I don't know how fast I'll run out of juice
Between
now and 4 o'clock this afternoon. So I'm trying to, I guess, dial it back just a little bit.
Pace yourself.
Yeah, pacing myself a little bit. But what people don't know is when you do what Bradley and I do in terms of batch filing, which is necessary, if you don't batch file your podcast as a podcaster, especially with a co-host and having guests on, inevitably, if you're trying to just do one a week, what happens is about 3 weeks into that, somebody can't make it or something's come up, and it's just so much easier to just do it like running a marathon. Do it, batch file them, forget it, and now you can move on down the road with other things you're doing. But talk to me a little bit about you. I want to hear, before we get started today, to give these agents some knowledge that maybe, you know, some may know, some may not know about some certain things. I wanted to ask you about this competitive trap shooting. How did you get into that, and what happened there?
I had been begging my parents for a goat. I thought they were just like really cute and I wanted a goat. And my parents said, "You're going to have to join 4-H and like really have a goat and be organized and take care of this goat if you want a goat." So I joined 4-H, and my mom comes to some of the meetings and stuff. I was like 10 or 11. And then they say like, well, we don't normally like recommend people start with an animal project. You should start with sewing. And I'm like, no, right. Not a skill that I will ever possess. And they're like, well, some people cook and bake. I'm like, well, yeah, no, I don't want to be in 4-H for that. I'm like, what's something else? And we go down this like laundry list of activities in 4-H that are not animal based. And trap shooting was on there. At this point, we're at home and I'm going through it with my dad even. I was like, what's trap shooting? And he's like, kind of looks at me sideways. Like, what do you mean? What's trap shooting? I was like, well, what's that one? And he's like, do you not know how Jerry, which had been one of the groomsmen in their wedding, did you not know that Jerry and I are friends and we used to like travel and do that? Like, what did you think Jerry and I were friends about? I was like, I don't know. I just figured you were friends. Like, how am I supposed to know? I'm 10 or 11, you know?
Right.
He goes and he has this big kind of like a like map drawer in our basement. And he like opens one of the lower ones and there's just like different little like certificates and all kinds of old pictures of him and Jerry, you know, going all around the country, like shooting. It was just what they enjoyed doing as young guys. And I had shot like the pistol before. I'd shot the rifle with my dad. Like he'd have me out shooting and like I was comfortable around guns, like enough even to ask. But I had never like shot a shotgun. I didn't know he had done this. I didn't know there's any like formal to it. And I was like, well, can I try that one? So we go out to the local gun club. We try shooting clay targets, trap shooting. And I liked it really well. I was like, well, this is a lot more fun. And they had a youth team there even. I was like, this is a lot more fun than 4-H where they keep asking me to go sew something like that. Right. That's just going nowhere quick. Yeah. And then I got pretty good at it. And I was on the Ohio, like state of Ohio team as a sub junior, which is when you're under 15, as a junior and as a lady. And when I went to college, then I won some national tournaments and stuff like that. But when I went to college, then I didn't like stay with it to the same degree, but like my little sister started a couple years earlier because I was doing it, you know, big sister was doing it. And she's now the top lady in the country for her average. And she's the second, she's like the second captain or whatever on the women's national team. So she went to work for Browning out of college. So yeah, she's like truly like the closest thing you could be to borderline like professional at it.
She's immersed in it.
Oh yeah, 100%. She travels all year round. Like she was just in Florida and then she'll go out to Arizona and to Las Vegas in the winter, like when Ohio, Cleveland area is like too cold and stuff. And she'll spend all summer traveling around the country doing it. And she, I think her average across every discipline right now is like 98 out of 100. So she'll miss 2 out of 100. And on a single target, she misses like 1 out of 3 or 400, which is crazy when you're talking about, you know, like a 4.5-inch little clay disc going 50 miles an hour away from you and you get a single shot at it. She's really wild at it. And there's a point that we were pretty neck and neck. And then I went to college and didn't stay involved at Ohio State. I just had a lot of other things I was doing. She did. She went to Miami of Ohio and they had a team there and she stayed involved. And like I said, went to work for Browning. So it's a little bit in our family genes. My great uncle, so my dad's uncle, there was a time that all of us got to shoot together. And that was like really cool to have three generations out there doing it, especially because my dad has three girls. So it's him, his uncle, and then like these three scrawny little girls. And my uncle's pretty darn, or great uncle, but he's pretty darn good at it. My dad is certainly very good. He doesn't shoot anymore, but yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It's very similar to Scott's auctioneer story.
Yes. Well, let me say this. This is a little unknown fact for everybody that most people don't know. And I don't know if this still stands true today or not, but I graduated from Marine Corps boot camp, Paris Island, in, I believe it was July of 1995. Okay, that's been a hot minute ago. So maybe this has changed since then. I don't know. But in July of 1995, there had been a whole bunch of Marines throughout history graduate from boot camp at Paris Island. That's kind of the place that Marine Corps training goes on. I mean, there's the San Diego has a recruit depot as well. But when I graduated in July of 1995, the record for most points ever accumulated on the rifle range at Parris Island was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, I don't know if somebody's beat her score since that time.
Yep.
But I found that, you know, if somebody would have asked me before I got there, like, okay, men, you know, because women go through Parris Island just like men do. But if somebody had asked me that question, I would have been like, oh, there's, yeah, a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we get there and they're like, oh, by the way, since y'all think y'all are so big and bad, the record holder at the rifle range is a woman. And I actually thought about that watching Caitlin, what's her name from Iowa?
Caitlin Clark
was shooting three-pointers. Yeah. That kind of came back into my head, yeah. Like, you know, rifle range, Parris Island, woman holds the record. This girl is shooting the ball from 24 feet and it's going in.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something to that. Maybe women from the standpoint of shooting and sighting in, maybe they're just better than men. I don't know.
If you look at like golf, you know, the LPGA golfers have way better swings and way better ball striking capabilities than the men. It's not even close.
Right.
Because a lot of the men golfers just default to just brute strength and they don't care how they hit it. They just need it to go in this direction. You know
right.
what I mean? But having gone to both PGA and LPGA tournaments, I've worked LPGA tournaments actually. Matter of fact, so I was the standard bearer in the Mobile LPGA tournament like 15 years ago. I was the guy that carried the scorecard, the big moving scoreboard.
Right.
And my group was, I was with Paula Creamer's group, who is a real popular golfer back in the day. She's retired now. Her caddy that week for the group I was with inside the ropes was Tiger's caddy this last week at the Masters.
Wow.
That's cool.
But having been to both, other than the distance the ball is hit, take that out of the equation, the ladies are way more impressive and way nicer.
Yeah. No doubt.
I don't know about that. I think I've been sassy probably my whole life. But Scott, in shooting, it was super interesting. Women are more likely to be opposite eye dominant. So you have to, you go through puberty a little bit younger, which is when your eye dominancy like could change and then begins to stick. So when I was a sub junior pre-15, I was doing a lot better than a 14-year-old boy. Because I had been going through puberty a few more years. I had kind of got more settled and locked into my eye dominancy than they had. And then certainly in rifle, where you're keeping track of wind speed and everything like that, having the ability to like monitor your eye dominance and like keep a peripheral vision going and all of that, I could see that even in rifle being a pretty big advantage and really helpful. So, and
right.
You know, women are more traditionally opposite eye dominant. And it's hard when you're going through puberty and it swaps if you were one and then the other.
Right.
But yeah, more often to be opposite. And if you live like that all day, every day, it makes you a little more well-rounded. It's kind of like being ambidextrous, you know?
Exactly. So our job today, Kat, is to help these agents any way we can. And there's three or four topics I wanted to cover today that you and I got on a call to talk about Indium. I believe it was early last week.
Yeah, was this right after you got out of the hospital?
Yeah, not long. But, you know, we got on this call, and I remember thinking to myself about three-quarters of the way through the call, this ought to be a podcast. Like, these agents need to see and hear some of what we're talking about, because I think for you and I, the original intent of the call was you had reached out to me to kind of get together to look at some of my agency data to see if us joining Indium was, you know, would that be something that could move the ball forward for iProtect, or based on us already being a member of the AC, which we're not planning on leaving, how does it shake out? Is it worth it for me? Is it worth it for our agency to do that for a lot of reasons? Or, you know, I think you and I are close enough that if it's not going to work for some reason, or it's not the best in my best interest and our agency's best interest, I know you'd tell me that and say, hey, man, you need to stay put. I mean, there's really nothing that we can do for you guys, because you've already got basically everything we have. But that led to so many different conversations. I remember thinking, Damn, this should have been a podcast. So let's start with the start, okay?
Yeah.
And we're this is going to flow into talking a little bit more about Indium and what, you know, you guys have going on. And there's been some interesting developments over the last 3 months. But so one of the things I think I said and you agreed with is there's so many different aggregator / cluster groups out there. And we both kind of agreed that every one of them has a little different nuance. And it you as an agency owner that's considering joining an aggregator cluster, you really need to do a deep dive into each one to see how they compare and contrast, and then try to make the best decision as far as, okay, here's where I'm at, and it seems to be that this particular aggregator / cluster is what I need because maybe I've been doing this a long time and I don't need a lot of hand holding. So this one kind of fits me, but maybe I just got in the industry 3 months ago and I don't know shit from shampoo about insurance and I need a lot of hand holding.
Right.
And everywhere in between, right? So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many different aggregators, networks, clusters, and that variance obviously is something that once you're in one of them, you can point to another model and say it's dissimilar. But to an agency, from the outside looking in, they can seem like one big lump sum, you know?
Right.
But there's so many different types because there's so many different types of agencies. Exactly to your point, if I'm a producer who just left a big agency that got acquired by Gallagher or Hub or Marsh, you know, I'm going to have a different perspective of what I want to do day one in my own agency. If I'm an agency owner who maybe was captive and now I'm going independent, I've already managed a team. I've already managed an office. You know, I've already done a lot of things that translate. So even those are simple ends of the spectrum, going from being a producer at a very large environment or being an owner in a smaller environment. Those are the ends of it, but there's everything in between too. You know, you have agencies that are multi-generational, and we certainly have a lot of that the son, the daughter have started to take over from an aunt or an uncle, a grandparent, a parent, and they're trying to get unstuck, you know, from what they used to do, and they're trying to modernize. Or you have rapidly growing agencies that are just, you know, hell on wheels and are doing a fantastic job. So, and you called it out, and I appreciate it during the intro. For Indium, it's very much growth centric, very heavy leaning towards commercial. Not that our agencies don't have personal lines, but when you look at the footprint of when an agency actually starts to engage with Indium, it's about 85% commercial, 15% personal lines. Most of the personal lines is high net worth, or if somebody's just out of state, you know, your favorite client moves from Alabama to Arizona and you're not appointed there and you don't want to lose them. Okay, cool. We'll help you out there, you know?
Or if you have, so like in our case, where we use Indium the most is if we have a company that operates in multiple states.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I might have CNA in Alabama, but it's, as you guys know, it's very hard to get CNA in Nevada, right? Mm-hmm. So it's better for us to place that account with Indium because you have the national contracts and yep. It just makes it a little bit simpler.
And we've been converting even over to global contracts. That's a great example too.
Yeah.
You know, because we're so commercially focused, we just got Chubb Global. We have Liberty's global program. We have an account that is based out of Sweden and then has operations in Detroit and Pittsburgh. And our agency here, one of our agencies here in Ohio happens to be the US, you know, agency working on it. But they have to match it up with a global program then. So yeah, 100%. It can be state because we're commercially focused. We can hem in a little bit more even to do international, which is really, really cool. Well, really fun.
And I'll tell you guys too, from my perspective, when you're looking at clusters, aggregators, market access, all that sort of stuff, you know, usually, especially if you're a newer agency or you're struggling to get markets, all you really care about is what markets are offered.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's not the only thing you should focus on.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the singular most important thing when it comes to clusters and aggregators is the exit clause and the exit strategy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's some clusters and aggregators out there that people like to diss on. because they have a robust exit clause. And personally, I think that's a good thing because, hey, here's the way out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The ones you should be scared of are the ones that don't have an exit clause or don't mention it and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And if you sign an agreement with one of these aggregators that has a very that doesn't allow you to take the business with you or doesn't allow you to sell it outside of the organization, that affects the value of your agency.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you how it happens. It's because you can't control who you sell it to. You limit your buyer pool. When you limit your buyer pool, the people who are in the buyer pool know they can pay less. And just an example for me, in the past 2 years, I have declined to buy three agencies, one as soon as last week, because they're with a very specific aggregator that I know plays really nasty games when people try to sell outside. And of course, what the aggregator is going to tell you, well, just join and you can keep the business. Well, no, then all we're doing is kicking the can down the road for Bradley to deal with. So that is the most important thing. I've got a buddy who's with another one than the one I just mentioned last week that he can only sell it. They're about a $2 million agency. The aggregator takes 50% of the renewals, but they handle service, air quotes. He can only sell it back to the org at a 1.5 times revenue multiple, but the revenue multiple is a multiple after the 50%.
That's rough. I think we all know that's rough. I don't even want to dig in and comment on that. That's really tough.
It's tough. And it's like, hey, it's great when you start out, but just like anybody who buys like real estate as an investment purpose will tell you, you've got to start with the exit plan first and work your way backwards.
Absolutely.
Can't go the other way. And that's one reason I was an investor in Indium. One of the main reasons I did that is you guys are very friendly when that situation comes up. If somebody wants to move outside, hopefully you provide enough value that they don't.
Right.
And you do. But it just makes it way easier. And it feels more like a direct contract, not you're being controlled by this overarching organization.
Well, and that's where we have twofold going on. You know, you have subcodes, and Bradley Chubb's actually a good example because you guys probably wouldn't have Chubb necessarily on your own, but you guys have a subcode, let's call it, in Indium, which it acts exactly like a direct code.
Yeah, we deal with the rep. Like it's, you know, same with Safeco. We rolled our Safeco business over to Indium.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So you're part of the, you know, you have alleviated production requirements. You still get to work with your rep. If you ever want to go with it because you still have a code with that carrier, you can go, you know, as long as the carrier is going to support it and doesn't say like, well, now that Bradley's out on his own, man, is that a mess? Like you're good to go. And certainly if you were acquired, you're good to go. Or Bradley, to your point, you know, you guys brought Safeco in for some safe harbor to it, you know, and you can move in and out. That's probably the part that's really unique to Indium. You can move in and out per carrier even. So if you're just having a really tough time hitting the nail on the head with a particular carrier, whether it's because it's a tough market, you maybe were doing well in a niche and now you're just not, or you've already, you know, done well in your region on that niche and it's just not as fast going as it first was, that's a good place to put it into Indium. Get more data on what's going on, you know, in the grand scheme of things too. So yeah, there's flexibility for us, even not just in the overall business model, but on how you implement it per carrier, you know, all the way through.
So here's what I did. I wrote down the 8 things, and you guys tell me after I finish if there's a 9th, 10th, or 11th thing that you would think about. But here's 8 things. And before I give my 8 things, I would definitely write down and explore before I joined any aggregator or cluster. Before I do that, here's the $1 million question. And there's going to be some agent out there that's going to thank me for asking this question. And it seems so easy, but we'll see if it's an easy answer or not.
I'm getting sweaty now. I'm nervous.
In the insurance industry, we have all of these names for all of this stuff, all the way, you know, at its simplest element, there are a lot of people that say the word agent or agency. Mm-hmm. It seems like the closer you get up towards Canada and into Canada, a what I would call retail independent agency would be called a retail independent brokerage. Mm-hmm. They use the word broker, and we use, especially down here in the South, the word agency a lot. But here's my question. Is there a difference between this interchangeable word aggregator and cluster? Is there a difference, or is it just the same word that's being interchanged, like agency and agent and broker?
I think it's the same word that's being interchanged. Yeah. I think,
and we have a lot of that in the industry, right?
Yeah, a lot. It's very regional too. Like if you go to California, retail agents are called brokers. In the Northeast, they're called brokers. I hate the word broker. I'm just going to go ahead and I don't like the word broker.
Really?
It makes me think of real estate, and I hate real estate agents.
Yeah, either real estate or Wall Street, like something to do with like real estate, and you're a big broker. It's a big word. It makes me think big. Like,
feels a little high strung sometimes. Yeah. 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 I think by the time I argued that I'm quote unquote an aggregator and Bradley argued he's quote unquote a cluster, we could be arguing the exact same points just because of, you know, our own experiences and our regions. I think aggregation is an activity that clusters and networks all do. I think you get into like bigger terms because Scott, you mentioned it, even market access can mean different things. It can mean aggregation, i.e. subcodes where everybody puts things in together, or like we even have a further end that we have market access on transactional pieces of business because we have an internal, and you'll love this, perfect timing, an internal brokerage where if Bradley picks up the phone and says, guys, I just don't know where this is going in the state of Iowa. You know, I don't know what carriers are there. I don't know what's going on in Des Moines for food trucks. We will then take that out to numerous carriers and come back to Bradley with some options. So that's where market access even gets tricky. Do you give me the market and then I individually access it myself? Or do you give me options to markets? You go access them and you present me my best options. So yeah, I think it's tomato, like you're just arguing about a lot of the same stuff.
I broke it down in a YouTube video last year. It's on my YouTube if you want to find it. But I basically put these groups in three categories. You have franchises, Goosehead, Brightway. In the middle, you have aggregators and clusters, and then you have market access companies.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go up the food chain, so market access companies are going to be the easiest to work with, the most open, the most agent friendly. You're probably not going to get as much hand holding as you would with the other two. Your franchises are going to be the most help, the most hand holding. It's an agency in a box. You press a button, you turn the key, and you're in and you're ready to go day one. But they're the most controlling, and you actually don't, in a lot of cases, own your business. And then your clusters and aggregators are going to be in the middle. You're going to have some that are going to give you a lot of help, but be a little more controlling. You're going to have some that are going to give you no help, but not be as controlling. That's how I sort of compartmentalize this. But like for us, I look at it the same way as I look at titles. You know, we don't put commercial producer on our employees' business cards because consumers don't know what the heck a producer does.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most like weirdest word to say, oh, I'm a producer. Like, what the freak does that mean? Like, do you make milk? Like, what are you doing? You know? And that's I tend to default to words that, because all that really matters at the end of the day is what does the customer think? And I tend to default to words that make it easy for the customer to understand. Most customers know what an insurance agent does. Therefore, that's why we at Portal say agent, whereas producer might be the more categorically correct term as it relates to consumers. And if a consumer calls in and says, hey, what do you guys do? Oh, we're a retail. Like, that doesn't help me. You know what I mean?
Right.
So first thing I'd like to say is this. Some of these aggregators and clusters that don't have buyback provisions, they don't have buy-in provisions, they provide market access. You can call and get some help, but it's not like they're reaching out to you every week to hold your hand. It almost feels like some of you guys are riding the white lightning of almost being a co-op, like a cooperative of some kind. Where and I think that's kind of what Bradley you know, market access.
Super true with what Indium was and even still is post acquisition.
Right.
We had 250, 300 agencies, you know, pre-acquisition or when I first got here. And of the three, call it 300, even on the high side, before we started like tidying some stuff up with people who'd been in for years, but not super active, out of all of those, 42 of them were equity holders. So at the end of the year, like, let's talk about an environment, to your point, Scott, like market access where nobody's beating down your door. And certainly your best friend Bradley's not going to come beat down your door. And he's not going to do anything to rake you over the coals when his own business is a participant. And then at the end of the year, what incentive does he have to take two extra dollars from his friend Scott instead of actually just like saying, Scott, why don't you just take me to lunch and let's talk about it. Let's work through it. You know, and that was one of the really interesting things about being agency owned. And still, like I said, to this day, we have obviously a larger group behind us now that gives us an incredible amount of resources and expertise that helps, you know, Bradley as a member even now. But in the grand scheme of things, there was no incentive to make Indium super aggressive in the business model or uncomfortable for independent agencies, because the owners were independent agencies that were in Indium, you know, and that was really cool. So yeah, it very much, my dad's a farmer. So it very much, when I explained it to him, he's like, so this is a co-op? I'm like, a bit. Yeah. Like,
I think co-op, I think you go down to like a more rural area of town where you have a 4x4 post with a metal roof and you buy eggs. So you mentioned acquisition.
Yeah.
That's sort of the big news that hasn't really been shared publicly yet in an official capacity. Talk about that real quick.
So December 31st of 2023, we were acquired by Assurex Global and then some of their more active agencies. And we're so phenomenally, we're still independently owned. Assurex Global is owned by independent agencies. So even the portion that they hold from a corporate standpoint and lead and guide us, and again, they're just a tremendous resource, support us through, is owned by agents. And then the grand total of Indium even is still owned by independent agencies. They're much larger. If you start to look at the Rolodex or member role, you know, out of Assurex Global, there's some phenomenally large teams. They're some of the largest even in the world. Granted, all of ours are the U.S. partners, but they're no slouch at what they do. And they've built custom programs with carriers. They've built some of their own programs. Their agencies are phenomenal resources about how to keep growing and scaling. And they view this as an opportunity to improve their locality, to support the whole independent agency channel, even into some smaller agencies. And it's probably an oversimplification, but to build a really damn great AAA ball team, you know?
And it's somewhat unprecedented, right? This is the first company they have acquired in a while, right?
I think they said at some point, and it's 20 and some odd change, but in over 20 years, yeah, they have done amazing work in our industry. I think they're just over $40 billion in aggregated premium, like across their whole environment. And for them, aggregation isn't even necessarily putting it all in one pile with a carrier. Some of it's just expertise, you know, what's going on in this market. How is this or that particular niche being served better? You know, what carrier's doing well here? And because of the amount they have, they obviously have an amazing relationship with a lot of the carriers, even to provide insight as to what's going on emerging, you know, in a region, you name it. So, yeah, but it's very unprecedented for them. They've had great success building it. And this is one of those occasions. Thankfully, they're here in Columbus and their CEO, Dean, is fantastic that they said, you know, buy it is a really great way to solve kind of a chicken and egg scenario where we could start to aggregate premium potentially and start to aggregate a relationship with hometown agencies in a way that still allowed Indium to be Indium, because we're still technically speaking our own company even, which is really great that we still have that space and autonomy to keep doing what we're doing. And we're not squished by a much, much larger, you know, partner behind us. So it's really cool.
So let me go back to go forward. Mm-hmm. I want to give the eight or nine things I would think about. And I'm going to do this quickly because we've got so much else we need to talk about. But I wanted to give in no particular order, but I'm going to start with where I would start. If I'm an agent and I'm listening to the IGP right now, and I'm getting ready to make some decisions about maybe Well, there's multiple things that could be going on here. Number one, you're not happy with the aggregator cluster you're with now, or you've decided to go out on your own and you don't know which one to join. And now there's 10, 12, 15, 20 of these things that you're like, I don't know. This would be Scott's decision-making process. This is the formula I would use. Number one, how much support handholding do I need from this particular aggregator, cluster, co-op, market access place do I need to feel comfortable about getting where I need to get to? Okay, that's number one. Number two, what carriers will I have access to with this particular aggregator or cluster? And will this move the ball forward and give me more bullets in my gun to use to go out and sell insurance? And that could even be, Bradley mentioned it earlier, guys, go out there and try to get like a direct contract with one of your carriers that are in your domiciled state in another state. And we haven't had a ton of success with that here. And I'm talking about working directly with the territory manager. So having this aggregator cluster that might have a national contract, as Bradley mentioned earlier, well, now maybe you can write that business in other states that you wouldn't have been able to otherwise. But I'd want to know what access I was going to have, and if I already had an agency, what other carriers is this going to give me? I'm just doing pro and con list. Number three, upfront fees and monthly fees. What are those? Am I willing to pay? Some aggregators and clusters say, hey, before you join, we need a check for $10,000, and this will be your monthly fees. Can you afford that? Is it worth those fees and possible upfront fee? The next one, I believe this is number three or four, buyouts and buyback provisions. Bradley mentioned it earlier, could affect your ability to sell your agency, right? Also, and this is what I never could get a piece about with buyback provisions and exit fees and those types of things, is it gave me this feeling of I'm almost back to being like a captive agent now, because I got this hanging out there. And as I said in the AC commercial I used to do on the podcast, every policy I sell, I'm just digging that hole just a little deeper and a little deeper. And one day I'm not going to be able to get out of it if I need to or I want to. And then it may actually prevent me from being able to sell my agency to a buyer like Bradley, because they're like, nope, you know, that
we don't like that guy. He wears skinny jeans and Air Force Ones.
Well, here's the other thing. Does the contract you're about to get into have one of these first right of refusals to buy your agency?
Yeah,
I've seen that before. So that was like the next one I had on here. Does joining this aggregator cluster hurt my ability to sell? The next one, you know, it was just an overall, based on the contract, how hard will this be to get out of if I ever want to get out of it? You know, the AC and some other clusters is like, look, give us 60 days notice or 30 days notice, or let us know and we'll start unwinding this thing without any, you know, you owe us $400,000 or you have to do this to get out of it. The next one I wrote down, who will own my business? Will it be the cluster aggregator that's going to own some of it or all of it, or will I own it? Because there's another one that would make me freak out a little bit, is if I found out every policy I write, maybe somehow they own it or something. I don't know, or part of it. I think that was pretty much it. There was like eight of them that I wrote down, or just things I would think about and look into before. Now, let me say this. Reasons to join an aggregator or cluster. Y'all just talked about it earlier, Bradley, you and Kat. It could help you from the standpoint of no requirement. Maybe you go get this direct appointment with this great carrier, but guess what? Now you got $150,000, $200,000 requirement. And if you don't meet that, you're going to lose that contract. So it takes a little of that pressure off, possibly. The next one could help you write business in multiple states. Bradley mentioned that earlier. I've got contracts with carriers, A-plus carriers in Alabama. Do not write this in another state or we're going to cancel your contract. Last but not least, and this is the one I wanted to get down to with Kat about, is this profit sharing, first dollar in stuff. So I've had agents reach out to me that maybe joined another aggregator or cluster that we promoted on this podcast, the AC, and they're like, I didn't get any profit sharing this year. Well, guess what? You've got 50,000, 100,000, maybe $200,000 worth of business, I can promise you one thing, with most carriers, if you have less than $1 million in premium, you are not getting profit sharing. Each carrier that you go direct with has this formula, this algorithm they use, but they're all like, oh yeah, and by the way, that formula doesn't even start until you get to at least $1 million or $2 million in premium. So you probably weren't going to get a profit sharing bonus anyway. Kat, would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that's where, like, yes, production alleviation's there when you could get a code through Indium, you know, and you might be able to take a slower start. You might be able to stabilize a little bit more under what would be a direct, you know, start. And there's other aggregators, you know, Market Access that have similar models. And then absolutely, like, contingency, profit sharing, overrides, you name it, those are all formatted a little bit different. Some of them have guarantees to them. You know, overrides are normally, you have a pretty big footprint, so you can have a guaranteed override. You get another 2%, something, you know, pretty flashy potentially. Contingencies are contingent upon your loss ratio, your growth, and a number of factors that the carrier comes back and says aligns well with what they're trying to do. And then you have profit sharing and things like that. And same even with profit sharing, the carrier has to look at what partners are most useful to continue coaching along in the direction we're going. And it's going to be hard, not that it's not never going to get there, but it's going to be hard for a carrier to look at somebody who has a $50,000 book compared to somebody who even has a $500,000 book or a $5 million book, you know, just in iterations, and say it's easy to coach them, or the time I spend coaching that agency is as good as the time I spend coaching that $5 million agency who has a team of producers who's just, you know, are already killing it with us. So that's where aggregation within, you know, subcodes and in a family of codes starts to really help. Suddenly now Bradley's is next to Scott's, and Scott's is next to Joe Schmo's, and all of them together look pretty nice. And the carrier can come to an organization that's centralized like Indium and say, hey guys, here's our initiatives for the coming year. Here's the regions. Here's the markets. Here's the things we'd like to do. Can you help us pivot and get in touch with the right agencies in your family of agencies? You probably know how Bradley operates a little bit better internally to his agency than even his best territory manager. You just have a closer relationship. You're managing less of them. Can you help us bridge the gap between knowing that, hey, this is a good agency and they're able to execute on what we'd like to be doing? And that's where aggregation, you know, serves the agencies really well and the carriers really well. If it's doing good work for the carriers, that's where they can come back then with some more competitive offerings that should be going out to the agencies. And Indium's able to be pretty generous with it. We give that back to our agencies. So even if an agency has a small book, call it 50,000, 100,000, they get a proportional amount back. So they're going to get less than the $1 million agency, but they're still going to get the proportional amount that the $1 million agency gets.
The thing I would add to that, Scott, is, you know, first right of refusals, I think, get a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not legal advice, but I don't think a first right of refusal is bad. All that means, generally speaking, is if you get an offer to buy your agency, the aggregator has the option to match that offer.
Right. And as long as it's spelled out that way in the contract, and maybe not a bad idea to have an attorney review the contract.
Absolutely.
But you're right, Bradley. That's not a bad thing if that's what it says.
Right.
If that's how the contract reads.
And then if they decline it, then you can go. What you want to be careful of is a first right of refusal. And this was the case with that one I mentioned earlier. If the first right of refusal includes, or the contract has, a non-compete with the carriers, where the aggregator has a non-compete with the carriers, because what will happen in that case is if you're the person buying the agency, you are essentially buying leads, because what's going to happen in most cases is the aggregator is going to say, hey, you let this agency move this business outside of our aggregator. We need you to non-renew all this business.
Right.
So you're buying. That's what you have to be careful of. It's more the, can you move it outside? Not the, you know, first right of refusals get sort of the the blanket blame for everything, but those, that's really not a huge issue. I've got some MGAs I work with that have first right refusal. You know, hey, if, because we work with a lot of MGAs, hey, if you move this outside, we get the opportunity. Okay, that's cool, you know.
Bradley, I want to ask you a question. We know that every aggregator slash cluster from a political standpoint has relationships with carriers, right? Just like Indium has relationships and these other aggregator clusters do. And it feels like each one maybe has a little different nuance in terms of what their profit sharing percentages are based on a number of different factors of how much premium that aggregator has with this particular carrier. And then relationships, just what I call the blanket politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure, and maybe I'm adding another one on here, a thing I would look at. I'm not so sure I wouldn't do a spreadsheet and say, here's my four aggregator clusters I'm looking at, and here's what they've given me in terms of what their percentages of profit sharing are and what they're going to take
mm-hmm.
from my profit. So in other words, like, I can't remember, Kat, what is like 20% that y'all take of the total profit sharing bonus?
Yeah, we keep 20% on the contingencies.
Right.
So the agency gets 80%. And then we don't keep any of the commission, because that's the other thing too. Bradley, I think, mentioned it with his buddy's agency. If the agency is placing the business, we don't keep any commission. But there's other organizations that say, hey, like, we'll keep 15% of the contingency, but every policy you sell, I'm going to keep 15% on that too. You know, it's more uniform across the ways, but that's an opportunity where you're digging a hole, you know?
I'll add one to that too. Another thing to the list is, do you have to use the aggregator's technology, or can you use your own? That's a big one. That's a big one. So like when I opened Portal, I had an aggregator that reached out to me and offered me what a lot of these folks do. In case you guys think about, we all probably know some kind of influential agency that's in this aggregator. Well, what these big aggregators will do is they will go to an agency that's moving and shaking and say, hey, join our aggregator. You keep 100% of everything.
Mm-hmm.
They give that agency a sweetheart deal as a mechanism. Yeah, as a mechanism to get other agencies to join. But the one that I was speaking to, you have to use their technology. And I was like, well, you're making me, you know, you're taking one of my swords away. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So can I operate 100% independent and my stuff will download into my system? I don't have to be on your technology. Now, to some agencies, especially if you're going, I think that's why a lot of former captive agents sign horrible aggregator agreements, is because they're used to Big Brother controlling absolutely everything they do. And they're still okay with a little bit of control. So for some people, hey, that may be cool. But for me, I was like, hey, I'm not going to be able to breathe unless I'm 100% in control of everything.
Right.
Yep. Well, and some people don't want it. You know, Bradley, you're pretty tech savvy to begin with.
Right.
You know, you do a lot of your own stuff. There's people that know that it's a pretty tight hold that they have on them now when you control your agency management system and you control your rater, you control your website, you know, you control your branding, you name it. Like, there's people that say, like, great, those are the things I'm least interested in anyway. I'm just going to put my head down and, like, just go sell. And, you know, we look at it and we say, like, well, those are levers to how I sell, that my brand matters, my customer experience that I can control, that journey internally with my technology matters. But there's other people that say, like, hey, just remove those factors. And to your point earlier on franchises, I think the closer you get to, like, hey, just leave me alone and, like, can you do my service? I'll just sell, take care of my technology. That's where franchises start to make sense for certain types of personality. Bradley, I think we're just too nosy and picky to ever be well managed or be well served.
When
you know?
It comes to the franchises that take a percentage for service, here's this has always been my thought. When you're small, it's great. But as you get bigger, it becomes a problem. So like my friend's agency, $2 million agency revenue, he's paying $1 million a year for service. Okay. Our agency is the exact same size, and we're paying a fraction of that
yep.
for service, and I'm overstaffed in that department.
Yeah, and you control the experience at that point for service.
Correct.
Like, you know exactly what you're going to get out of it at that point.
Hey, if you want to build a small agency and stay around $2 to $3 million in premium and just make your living, you know, I looked at an agency for sale recently that was $300,000 in revenue, and their expenses were $25,000 a year.
That's a great lifestyle for
these
somebody.
These guys are freaking crushing it. Like that, that's great. You know, if you want to just stay small and make, you know, a couple hundred grand a year and not really grow and just be like the local hometown agency that's there forever. And hey, that I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about matters a lot less.
Right.
But if you want to be in the, you know, 10 million, 15, 20, 25, 30, 50, 60 million in premium, which is really where the freedom is in this business, long term, you're really shooting yourself in the foot.
So, guys, I got another question for you guys, and then I'm going to go to my last question of the day, and we're going to let Kat go. Number one, you know, these carriers, because they haven't been profitable, as profitable in PNC as they would like to be, are making a lot of changes right now in terms of really sharpening their pencil with operational expenses within the carrier. And then they're also doing some other things like, you know, in my opinion, starting this process of, putting a little bit more of that risk on the policyholder in terms of modifying policy language to increase in deductibles and, you know, limited roof replacement coverage, which is basically roof ACV on roofs older than 10, you know, all this stuff to kind of help profitability, right? Well, one of the ways that they could assist with that profitability function might be to stop working and playing well with aggregator cluster groups where they maybe lower profit sharing or something. Is that a possibility, do you think, Kat? Or how do they view aggregators and clusters right now is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I think any time that there's an inequitable balance in a relationship, you're going to have to, when put under stress, you know, if you don't have a good marriage and then you have a baby and you're under stress, it's not going to get better.
Right.
So I think anytime right now we're kind of in that phase that, you know, if the relationship isn't really good, we're going to put it under a microscope and see what needs to change about it. That said, when you do have a really good marriage, it stands out amongst the crowd. And I think that's right. The really interesting thing that Indium, because we've always been super agency friendly, we've always maintained really good relationships with the carriers because the carriers didn't ever feel like we were over leveraging them or our agencies. And that's the same thing Assurex has done. You know, they have some huge agencies in there, but they've just never been in a position to be bullies. So the partnership there is pretty well balanced. I do think there's other aggregators, though, and other even just large agencies that when you've raked somebody over the coals time and time and time again, and they don't have a lot in their reserves, you know, like technically, financially for some of these carriers, or, you know, reinsurance is changing. They have a mother-in-law that's in their ear yelling at them about this, and this. It's going to put some additional stress on the marriage, and it's going to put them in a position that they may not be doing as well as they once were, or they're going to have some additional hoops to jump through to get back on track. So yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I think we're seeing that. I think, unfortunately, too, small agencies see it too, that what, to your point, Scott, you know, maybe at $1 million, this or that carrier used to offer a little bit of profit sharing or a contingency. You weren't going to get an override yet, but you maybe were going to be able to play for something. The carrier just can't go that far down the food chain anymore to play there, because they're just spread too thin, you know, and it absolutely varies by carrier. It varies by the attitude of the agency. It varies by things outside of both the agency and carrier's control. You know, when we start looking at different states and regulations they're passing, you know, it's a multifaceted matrix that we're all playing on. But yeah, I definitely think we're seeing that across the industry as a whole, and aggregators, franchises, market access, wherever you fall on that spectrum, we are not exempt from it, you know?
So my last question of the day, Here it comes. We were talking the other day and you pulled up this spreadsheet that I believe you'd gotten from something you'd jumped on with Chris Brand, who's kind of an expert in all things carrier valuation, agency valuation. And I was stunned by some of the metrics on that. So I think at the top of the list, we probably can talk about, which was the
Berkshire Hathaway,
extraordinarily large percentage of reserves that Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett, had so much more in reserves at, I believe, 26.5%, somewhere in that range. Talk a little bit about what I'm speaking of in case these agents don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, Chris is the absolute guru to follow, and he has a newsletter that I've been on now for last 6, 8 months or so, and it's awesome. Everybody should go sign up. But there's carriers that maintain their own reserves. There's carriers that then have to go supplement that with reinsurance. And again, it varies state by state, and Chris certainly can give you a heck of a lot more depth. But one of the things that I thought was super interesting, and Scott, you and I were talking about, was what position are some of these carriers in to continue growing? If you've only got a quarter of a tank of gas left, you don't have a lot to go before you're pulling into the service station again and going to fuel back up. You know, you're going to stop and get a sandwich. You're going to fill up the car again. You're going to have to take a break pretty quick here. And there's a few agent distribution. And there's a few direct-to-consumer carriers that are sitting in a really great place as to their reserves and their position to do a fantastic job over the next 18, 24 months and start growing. And then there's some national carriers, you know, household names that are sitting in a place that they're going to have to pull into the gas station here pretty quick and look at how they get things fueled up and ready to go. And I think just being aware that the AM Best rating is a quick snapshot, and it's really meant more for the consumer than it is for us as agencies, agency owners, networks, clusters. We should be diving a layer deeper. And if that's just reading, you know, Chris's newsletter, or whether that's through an aggregator and a relationship that gives you access to more of that conversationally, or, you know, in information, we should all be doing it. You know, that's the next layer of expertise we're meant to bring to the relationship, you know?
Well, and if a carrier has, and I'm not going to name any names, but you know, some of these carriers over the years have been bullish on taking float, which is customer premium, right? Before you pay out a claim, you get the premium in, take that float and invest it. And then the age-old thing that carriers have always done is this very safe harbored investment for most carriers have been preferred bonds. Bonds are a safe investment. Some carriers, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, anybody can Monday morning quarterback this, but they have over the years invested quite a bit of float into commercial real estate. That is about to come to roost. If you've got this, you know, probably billions of dollars invested into commercial real estate, which, by the way, is not real liquid, right? Unless you're going to fire sell it. Well, now we need to, if we try to unwind that right now, you've seen kind of what commercial real estate has done in the past couple of years. It is not, nobody's just gagging to jump on commercial real estate unless they get it on pennies on the dollar. That's a problem. That's a problem.
I mean, that's an easy one because we all see it every day in our own, you know, offices and in our own neighborhood and stuff. But there's certainly others that have portfolios that same thing post-COVID. We have not seen the ripple effects of how it's going to impact that type of investment portfolio where that carrier has maybe put a large amount of its, you know, reserves and money on hand. So it's got a lot of depth. To me, it's really interesting. I think the, you know, economics that are pushing the industry behind the scenes are as interesting as our daily lives. It helps two and two make four. Sometimes, you know, we're left scratching our head as to why did this decision come up or why did this or that change. It helps put the pieces together, certainly.
So guys, let me give you a flavor, just an example. I try to simple this down to how Scott could understand it. If I have a couple million dollars in the bank, okay, Scott has a couple million dollars in the bank, 800 credit score,
Hypothetically.
hypothetically, 800 credit score, and I will go down here to my local bank and I say, hey, I'd like to borrow $500,000. They would be glad to do that, happy to do that. And my interest rate on $500,000 or whatever is going to be, you know, pretty low, pretty, you know, the best, probably best in class, right? For what they're going to give me. Conversely to that, if I've got a 500 credit score and I've got $30 in a Snickers bar in my account, A, I'm going to have a lot higher interest rate, or I'm not going to be able to get the loan. So when we talk about Berkshire Hathaway being at 26%, having 26% in reserves compared to the next carrier, all of these percentages and amounts that they have in reserves also affect how much reinsurance they can purchase and at what price. Mm-hmm. So in other words, Berkshire Hathaway is getting best in class, lowest cost because they've got so much. Who was the next carrier behind them and what was their percentage compared to Berkshire?
I don't remember offhand. I want to say it was another direct-to-consumer, though. I don't think it was an agency distribution one, and that's not to put our agency channel under fire. It's just, you know, how many levers can you control? Or it might have even been, I want to say it was another direct-to-consumer one, you know, in that, like, State Farm type family. It might have been somebody like a Progressive that has a hybrid model but still distributes right. heavily centralized. But I don't remember it being one of our big household names that really bolsters the independent channel. And again, that does not mean that there is no opportunity to get things straightened out for those national carriers. They're going to figure it out. They didn't get this big overnight by accident, you know?
Right.
So they'll get it straightened out. But it's one of those things where we're going to still watch them slow down to speed back up. They're going to have to pull off the side of the road, get some gas, refuel, get everything going. And then we'll see them start to pick up. And it'll be good for the market, realistically. You know, if Warren Buffett can afford to get the market going again, I'm happy to watch him do it. And then I'm happy to see the independent agents, you know, thrive on solid carriers after that, you know. So we'll get there. It is just fun to be at kind of the corner, like the very start of the curve, and be able to, through some of that insight that Chris has, begin to see around the curve and say, like, okay, like, well, where are we going to put a lot of effort behind relationships, and what more can we do to support those?
So, Kat, for any of these agents listening to this podcast right now, if they want to get in touch and learn more about Indium and what you guys, and by the way, folks, I'm not being paid a dime for this today, so please don't think this is a plug for Indium. In fact, Kat and I are still in, after a pretty good little bit of work, kind of a fact-finding mode to see if mm-hmm. it even makes sense for me to join Indium. We have not made that decision yet.
Yeah, I wish I had just given him the sweetheart deal that Bradley was mentioning, where you just pick fancy agents and you give it to them for free. And by now, Scott would already be singing our praises. But
right,
nope, yeah. Scott and I are both stubborn mules arguing with each other over numbers all day, every day still.
That's right. So how do they get in touch with you, or they want to get in touch with Indium to find out more? Maybe they're looking into getting an aggregator cluster group and they want to add you to that list of, hey, here's five I'm going to look at.
Yeah, our website is goindium, all one word together, .com. And Indium, for anybody who wasn't used to spelling it, just like I wasn't on my way in here, is Indium. So goindium.com. And then my email is kterness@goindium.com. So you are more than welcome to reach out personally. We have it set up on our website that you can kind of explore and start to get to see what carriers we have, what our team's like, how we interact. You can even schedule an appointment to talk about Indium on there. We have anywhere between 10 to call it maybe 15 agencies a week that say, like, hey, I'm interested in talking to you guys. And to Scott's point much earlier, we're going to shoot you pretty straight. We take about one of those 10 to 15. And that's not because it's some exclusive social club. I'm friends with that guy on the podcast here that wears skinny jeans and Air Force Ones all day. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're the right fit. And there's going to be agencies who want, need, and should have more handholding. And we're pretty laissez-faire. Like I said, we're pretty commercially focused. So there's agencies that are looking for a lot of help on personal lines, and we won't be the right fit. But we're happy to have the conversation. We're happy to point you in the right direction and help you sort through what you're thinking about. So that's the best way to get a hold of us.
Thank you, Kat. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Guys, you are listening to the Insurance Guys podcast. And as I end every episode, rewards come from action, not discussion. Get your ass out from behind that desk today. Here's what I need you to do today, okay? I need you guys that are thinking about joining an aggregator or cluster group. You know, there are levels to this game that we call insurance. And you've got to make great decisions. Long term, you know, something that may seem like, oh, well, we just need to make a decision and run with it. This would be one of those decisions that however this thing shakes out for you, when you join an aggregator or cluster, could potentially affect your agency and you personally from a financial standpoint for really decades, because you know there's about three or four things in the insurance business that once you join up, it's kind of hard to go back the other way. I would say this would be one of them. Nobody wanting to join four or five different clusters over a four or five period of time, year period of time. So this is a huge decision. You need to be very thoughtful about it. You need to get all the information gathered up. And I mentioned earlier, and Bradley talked about, and Kat talked about, and do your dead level best to make a fantastic decision on which one is right for you and your agency so that you can put your head on the pillow and know that maybe 10 years down the road, because of the decision I made in 2024, I'm not going to be regretting that decision in 2036, right? So do me that favor. Be very thoughtful and do some due diligence. Don't make a decision in 30 minutes. But as I end every podcast, rewards come from action, not discussion. Get your ass out from behind that desk today. Go out into the big, bad world. Build relationships. Become the mayor of your village. Write business and make money for your family, your wife, your husband, your kids' college fund, and for your parents and your in-laws that are struggling out there today. Go write good business for them and write good business for the companies that you represent and the agencies that you represent. Bradley Flowers, I love you.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Kat.
Thank you, Kat. We love you too.
Thank you, guys.
Guys, you are listening to the Insurance Guys podcast, and we love each and every one of you. Thank you so much for being a part of our family. We'll see you back here real soon. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Insurance Guys podcast. If you need to know more about me or you need to get in touch with Scott, you can always reach me at theinsuranceguyonline.com or email me at scott@iprotectinsurance.com. And if you need to get in touch with Mr. Bradley Flowers, go to portalinsurance.com or email him at bradley@portalinsurance.com. Guys, we love you. We thank you so much for listening to our show and being a part of our family. And we look forward to seeing you again next week on the next episode of the Insurance Guys podcast. Take care.